Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure to be joined by Ed Haslam, the author of Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, the story of an underground medical laboratory published in softcover by the Wordsworth Press and copyright 1995. We've been detailing events that were going on in the city of New Orleans and which overlap the city of New Orleans, the Tulane University, I should say. We've been talking about Dr. Alton Oxner, an individual with more connections than a switchboard, very prominently connected in not only the city of New Orleans, but also to Tulane University, both in turn very significant for America's political, national security, and economic connections to Latin America. Oxner was basically in charge of the Information Council of the Americas, a right-wing propaganda outfit with apparent intelligence connections that was involved with setting up an interview with Lee Harvey Oswald, in which he proclaimed his Marxist-Leninist sympathies, and that had much to do with tainting Oswald red, and an event well known to researchers into the Kennedy assassination. We have been talking about an individual who was working for Alton Oxner and also for Tulane University, Dr. Mary Sherman, one of the foremost names in American medicine, although sadly overlooked in the 1950s and 60s. Someone, by the way, whose work is still frequently cited in contemporary medical journals, although she's been dead for more than 30 years. Is that not true?
That is true. That is true.
We have also been speaking about David Ferry, the initial focus of Jim Garrison's investigation, an individual who was involved with the U.S. intelligence community's efforts against Fidel Castro, and who also may very well have been involved with some of the events surrounding President Kennedy's assassination. We were talking about allegations by Perry Russo that David Ferry, and I personally believe these are absolutely accurate, that David Ferry, Clay Shaw, Oswald, and some anti-Castro Cubans were discussing how President Kennedy could be killed. And we've been talking about Guy Bannister's detective agency, an apparent intelligence front with which Lee Harvey Oswald was involved, for which David Ferry certainly worked, and which also, as we've seen, was connected with the Information Council of the Americas, Ed Butler, and through that to Alton Oxner. As you mentioned, Ed Oxner in many ways was sort of the glue that stuck many of these elements together. Now, the title of your book talks about Mary Ferry and the monkey virus, and indeed, it is fascinating and I think potentially enormously important fact that Mary Sherman, the brilliant cancer researcher, the medical pioneer, was apparently working with David Ferry on a very strange project. Could you tell us about that?
Sure. When Garrison reconvened his investigation into the Kennedy assassination in 1966, his primary target was David Ferry, because David Ferry had been associated with Lee Harvey Oswald, and he had been involved in training anti-Castro Cubans for an assassination attempt on Fidel Castro. That made him an extremely suspicious person from Garrison's point of view. In the process of investigating David Ferry, Garrison found out a lot of things about Ferry that most people didn't know. One of the most interesting things was that Ferry was, for some reason, running a secret cancer lab. And while Ferry himself was a loose cannon with no formal medical training, the scale of the laboratory was remarkable because it had nearly 2,000 mice in it, and it was determined by Garrison's investigators that Ferry was involved with Dr. Mary Sherman in this effort. Now, the inclusion of Dr. Mary Sherman, one of the most prominent cancer researchers in America, a professor at a medical school, a director of a cancer lab, and a graduate of the University of Chicago Medical School, put a very serious twist on David Ferry's cancer research. Further, they found a document in Ferry's apartment when they arrested him, which explained how to use viruses to cause cancer. And Garrison was really only allowed one unedited interview during his 1960 JFK assassination. That was an interview in Playboy magazine. And in that October issue of Playboy magazine, Garrison stated in unequivocal terms that his investigators had determined that David Ferry was involved in this secret cancer experimentation with Dr. Mary Sherman.
Bear in mind that Mary Sherman worked not only at Tulane Medical School, she taught there, was an associate professor, but she worked for Alton Ochsner's clinic. In fact, Ochsner brought her to New Orleans.
And that combination between David Ferry and Mary Sherman was not only bizarre in terms of trying to understand what forces would pull these disparate people together. I mean, Mary Sherman, a highly respected medical professional, and David Ferry, this loose cannon who was running around as a contraband pilot and private investigator for Guy Bannister and training Cubans to assassinate Castro. I mean, what forces would pull them together? And that was really the crux of what drove me on the book. The second thing was that also meant that Ferry's cancer experiments were not loose, harebrained things. They were being conducted by a professional who really knew what she was doing. And it wasn't until we found this treatise. In fact, I looked for over a year for this document that Garrison had mentioned in the Playboy interview, and we finally found it in the National Archives because Garrison had given the document to the House Select Committee on Assassinations in 1979, and the National Archives had filed it away. And it was released as part of this JFK assassination papers that came out after Oliver Stone's movie. So we were able to get the actual document. And when you start to study that document, the first thing you'll understand is that David Ferry did not write it. It was written by a leading-edge, top-of-the-line cancer researcher working at the very highest levels of American medicine. And how David Ferry got it is a question. But what it really meant was the capability that they had in their hands was to induce and create and transfer cancer from animal to animal.
And specifically, they were injecting mice with monkey viruses to induce cancer.
That is correct. And that bit of information came to me from people very close to the Garrison investigation who I went to school with in New Orleans.
You mentioned a fellow named Nicky Chetta, the son of the coroner for New Orleans at that time.
That's right. When Clay Shaw was acquitted in March of 1969, Chetta, who was a classmate of mine, was furious over it. And we were all kind of furious over it in one way or another because we had seen how much the press had distorted and misrepresented everything that was going on. And so Chetta really tried to set the record straight by telling us, his classmates, what was going on. And his perspective on the investigation was through the eyes of his father, and his father was the coroner of the city of New Orleans. And when David Ferry died, several days after the Garrison investigation became public, Dr. Chetta went over to Ferry's apartment to investigate the scene and pronounce the cause of death, et cetera, on Ferry. And it was at that time that he observed all these women's dresses in Ferry's closet, these priest vestments, which Ferry kept, and all this medical equipment that was there in his apartment with a group of mice. And Chetta's further explanation was that they had investigated other landlords, and they had found out that Ferry had thousands of mice and was working on some sort of big-scale cancer project.
We should know, too, that as something of an aside before we get to the laboratory, that when the House Select Committee on Assassinations turned in its final report, as badly compromised as it was, among the recommendations to the U.S. Department of Justice was that they begin investigating David Ferry and the anti-Castro Cubans in New Orleans, vindicating Garrison after all the expletive deleted that was heaped on his head.
Yeah.
I also think that Oliver Stone deserves a mighty tip of the hat for his, I consider them heroic efforts in JFK. He took a few artistic liberties in a few places, but it was basically historically accurate. And he got the Garrison treatment. He was dumped on and continues to be dumped on.
Yeah, before the movie was even released.
I know. And I think both Garrison and Oliver Stone deserve a much more prominent place in American history than they will ever receive. They're both, to me, this will sound a little corny, they're both, to me, real heroes. Back to the subject of this clandestine laboratory, which is the major focal point of your book, Ed. As you began to develop the story, it appears that the relatively small number of mice in David Ferry's apartment did not constitute the laboratory itself, but rather an adjacent building was the real laboratory. Could you tell us about that adjacent apartment or nearby apartment and how you came across that?
Well, this is another fluke in my life, which is as interesting and unusual as the day I found Guy Bannister's files without looking for them. I was not looking for David Ferry's apartment either. I was pursuing a pretty girl who I had met on a college campus at Tulane, and she had just rented this new apartment not far from campus. And I went over there, and she had just moved in, and the only piece of furniture she had in there was a waterbed. And it turned out that, I mean, the apartment was really unusual in that everything, the floors had been stripped and revarnished, and the walls had been sanded and repainted, and everything was in absolutely mint condition, but it still smelled. There was a strange smell in there. And so this girl I was dating, Barbara, went downstairs at one point and talked to the old woman who lived in the basement. And the old woman who lived in the basement indicated that there was something very strange going on up there, and she kept saying this single sentence over and over again about those horrible men and the terrible things they did to those animals. Well, this was an unusual experience in my life, but it wasn't significant until I began my investigation 15 years later and discovered that David Ferry lived across the street. Then I had to look at this apartment in relationship to David Ferry. And one of the other things that I was told when I was at the apartment was the apartment had been taken off of the market for about 5 years. Why would you take a piece of rental property off the market for 5 years?
Certainly not a way to make money.
That's right. It's not a way to make money. But it turned out that Ferry's apartment across the street, which also had the same smell of mice in it, was also taken off the market for 5 years.
And we should bear in mind that it was in this laboratory that David Ferry was working with Dr. Mary Sherman of Tulane Medical School and the Ochsner Medical Clinic on injecting mice with monkey viruses to induce cancer. More about this laboratory and how you came across it, Ed.
Well, the first thing about the laboratory is the size of it. It was estimated that Ferry had 2,000 mice. Now, if you say, okay, how do you house 2,000 mice? Let's say we put 5 mice in a cage. That's 400 cages of mice. Now, just imagine in the apartment or house that you're sitting in listening to your radio right now, imagine putting 400 cages of mice into that facility. And imagine the task of feeding them and cleaning up their cages after they've pooped and peed and stuff on there. And imagine the smell. And then imagine injecting them with cancer-causing monkey viruses. You are not going to want to live in that apartment. And that's why nobody lived in that apartment. It was a dedicated lab, but it was located across the street from Ferry's apartment so that Ferry could keep an eye on it and can go over and make observations on it. So it was closely connected with Ferry, and Ferry kept some mice back at his apartment. And my guess is these are mice he kept for breeding and control reasons, and they were not injected with the monkey viruses.
You mentioned an apparent anti-Castro Cuban named Miguel, who was also sort of shepherding this laboratory, and you also discussed the possibility that the lab may have doubled as a safe house.
Yes, all that's accurate. One of the things that Barbara had told me was that there was this man upstairs who had invited her to this bar. And she told me the location of the bar, and I knew from being around New Orleans that that was one of the ground zero spots where the anti-Castro Cubans gathered. And I suggested that it would not be an appropriate thing for her to go with him. But I met the guy later when he came down to see her one day. And he worked in very suspicious circumstances, et cetera. And I really believe, my conclusion, if I can just make it brief here, is that he was left there to shepherd this property back on to the market, and he had been one of the anti-Castro Cubans that had been associated with David Ferry, who lived across the street, and that they were all part of this underground railroad that brought these exiles up from Miami so that they could be trained by Guy Bannister and then sent back on military missions or paramilitary missions against Fidel Castro and his government.
Now, the lab, as you mentioned, was across the street from David Ferry's apartment, so he could keep an eye on it. It also was very centrally located, strategically located, with regard to Mary Sherman's apartment, and also with regard to the path that she would take to get to work at Tulane.
If you just sort of looked at a map of the city of New Orleans, and over on the left was Ochsner Clinic, and you put an A there, and over on the right was Tulane Medical School, which is kind of downtown. You put a B there. This laboratory and David Ferry's apartment was almost dead center between the two. And then if you just came down 2 miles down Louisiana Avenue, straight down from that lab, you were at Mary Sherman's apartment. So it was 2 miles from Mary Sherman's apartment, and it was directly on the major road connecting her two offices. So there was plenty of access and plenty of propinquity on it.
You mentioned, you theorize about the possibility that it may have been under the auspices of Guy Bannister's detective agency, an apparent intelligence front, among other things, that the laboratory was set up. Could you tell us a little about that?
Sure. The puzzling question that really bothered me throughout the entire book is, why would Mary Sherman associate herself with David Ferry? And the possibility came up that maybe she had not done so voluntarily. Maybe this association was really an association between other people who were not in the picture that these two people both reported to. And Mary Sherman reported to Alton Ochsner, and David Ferry reported to Guy Bannister. Well, maybe it was the association between Alton Ochsner and Guy Bannister, which we've already established through the files, etc., that was the real reason for Mary Sherman and David Ferry to be associated together.
Now, Mary Sherman met an unhappy end just before the Warren Commission came to New Orleans to investigate the New Orleans connections to the assassination. Could you tell us a little bit about, well, we're going to get to the precise physical circumstances, but this took place when? Was it June of 1964?
It was July 21st, 1964. And it was a front-page murder story, and if you ask anybody in New Orleans, the murder of Mary Sherman is the most sensational murder story that's ever happened down there.
We're going to get into the exact physical circumstances of her killing. As you began to pursue the David Ferry-Mary Sherman connection, and in turn began to look into the murder of Dr. Mary Sherman, you contacted a fellow whom you referred to as Big Mike, who was well-connected with law enforcement in New Orleans. And in your book, you describe that Big Mike got quite a surprise as he began trying to find out about that murder.
Yeah, the investigation into the Mary Sherman murder was shut down. I mean, obviously and overtly and from above, and with a lot of power. And it disappeared. Everybody ran for cover after the power came down. And that was in 1964. In 1972, 7 years later, I asked a man who was an investigator for the district attorney's office if he could secure he volunteered to secure a copy of the police report on Mary Sherman. He had not been in town in 1964 when the murder happened, and therefore he had not seen how badly it was shut down. And he thought it was going to be a routine thing because he pulled police reports on murders all the time, because that's what he did for a living. And I asked him, our first conversation was on Wednesday about 6 o'clock, and on Friday at about 5 o'clock I talked to him the second time. And the first time, our conversation, he was confident and buoyant, and he was going to get this report for me, and there wasn't going to be a problem, anything else. And by Friday, he was screaming at me on the telephone saying, "What the hell did you get me into? I have never seen flack like this. I have done nothing for the last 48 hours except explain why I want to see this report." And he said, "Do you know how stupid I sounded when I told him it was a teenager who asked me for it? He was a friend of my daughter's." At any rate, Big Mike tried to get the report, and it blew up in his face, and all it did for me was confirm that the rumors that I had heard about all the political heat and the cover-up on the Sherman murder were in fact true, and that's why I had to pursue it later.
Speaking of cover-ups, or of the Dr. Mary Sherman murder, in frankly, I view it as a piece of propaganda, not journalism, but in the book Case Closed by Gerald Posner, one of the pieces of offal that the author floats in an attempt to debunk the notion that there was a conspiracy behind Kennedy's assassination is the notion that the many curious deaths and suspicious murders that took place in connection with the investigation into Kennedy's assassination were not suspicious at all. On page 135 of your book, you quote a section from Posner chapter called The Non-Mysterious Mystery Deaths, in which he describes the death of Dr. Mary Sherman as follows. Dr. Mary Sherman, house fire, had no connection with the case, though she was acquainted with David Ferry. According to the medical records, she was killed in an accidental fire. That is, shall we say, less than accurate. Can you tell us how Mary Sherman died? What were the wounds and the injuries that killed her?
Well, first of all, I want to say that Posner's comment is a bold-faced lie. It is not an erroneous comment. It's a bold-faced lie because he says the medical records say, or the medical records show. Well, I guarantee you that I have the medical records. They're published in full in the appendix of my book. And the medical records say, and the police reports say, that Mary Sherman was murdered. She had 13 stab wounds on her, and her body was set on fire. Okay? And her right arm was missing. And for Posner, if you've ever seen him on television, you know how he talks in this sort of certain, everything is absolutely true, he's completely right on everything, and he throws out all this information, you know, that nobody could possibly challenge. He said this thing about Mary Sherman with that same level of confidence.
Well, and, we should just add, perhaps he was simply given incorrect information just to cover ourselves legally. Go ahead.
Yes. But he should not have said that the medical records show. All right. He had the right to say, you know, I think Mary Sherman died in a house fire. All right. But he should not have said the medical records show, because that's not what the medical records show. The medical records show that Mary Sherman had, approximately 8 to 13, depending on how you count them, stab wounds on her. And the cause of death, as determined by the coroner, was a stab wound to the heart.
Not an accidental death in a fire. Now, one of the things you point out in your book in investigating the murder of Dr. Mary Sherman, which again took place just before the Warren Commission came to New Orleans, is that there appears to have been a cover-up concerning her death. In particular, some of the people that were involved with discovering and or identifying the body had their professional connections obfuscated, despite the fact that the professional connections of other people were accurately stated, people who were irrelevant. I'm thinking of Carolyn Talley and Juan Valdez, among others.
And let's start with the victim. Can you imagine a police report about a murder where it doesn't even say where the victim worked?
And, of course, she worked at Tulane Medical School. She also was working for Dr. Alton Oxner's clinic. And as we are now discovering, she also was involved in an underground laboratory with, of all people, David Ferry, injecting mice with monkey viruses to induce cancer. Go ahead.
The homicide report has deals with five people who are really essentially irrelevant to the investigation and are only put in there to raise suspicions about Mary Sherman being a lesbian. And all five of those people, it is clearly stated where they work. The person who identified the body, however, who is Dr. Carolyn Talley, who is a pediatrician at Tulane Medical School, and perhaps also, or she at least lived next door to the Oshner Clinic. I don't know if she worked there or not, but she was a close friend of Mary Sherman's. Her professional relationships are not mentioned. It does not say that she worked for Tulane Medical School. The person who reported the fire, Mary Sherman's next-door neighbor, was Juan Valdez, a Cuban exile who worked at the International Trademark Building. Of course, Clay Shaw had formerly been the general manager of the International Trademark. By the way, Clay Shaw was brought into the trademark by Ted Brent, and the hotel, which is on the grounds of the Oshner Clinic, is called the Brent House because Ted Brent donated approximately $1 million to the Oshner the Foundation Clinic and Hospital.
That will do it. You also mentioned that another Sherman neighbor, David Gentry, was an acquaintance of Oswald.
Well, he wasn't a Sherman neighbor, but he was the last person other than the maid and janitor to see Mary Sherman alive.
Oh, okay.
And Mary Sherman had picked up some... he worked at a store that she frequented, and it turned out that he was Lee Harvey Oswald's next-door neighbor.
Now, you've alluded to the homophobic, perhaps one could say, quote, lesbian angle, unquote, cover-up to this. The press made a sensational quasi-case, or at least they presented the killing as some sort of lesbian jealousy situation. And this appears to have been simply a red herring. Could you tell us about that?
Sure. We've just summarized it. It's a red herring. The press said what the police told them, and that was that Mary Sherman had been slashed to death and then set on fire by an intruder. Then it was determined that there was no forced entry, and then it was assumed that Mary Sherman had let the intruder in, and she must have had a reason for doing that at night, and that intruder must have had some form of personal relationship with her. That's why they slashed her up and set her on fire. And that was the entire explanation that the public was given about the Mary Sherman murder. Well, when you get the autopsy report and you start to analyze what happened to Mary Sherman and you start to study the knife wounds and you start to study the burns, you come to the inevitable and inescapable conclusion that Mary Sherman could not have died in her apartment.
We're going to talk about how Mary Sherman died, where she died, and the significance of that in the next segment of our interview, because we're almost out of this, out of time for this half hour. I've been speaking with Ed Haslam, the author of Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, the story of an underground medical laboratory published in soft cover by Wordsworth Press, copyright 1995. For Ed Haslam, this is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.